Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And welcome to the Following On podcast from TalkSport. I'm John Norman, and today bringing you a special interview with a special player. We've all got these kind of players in our lives, the type that may play for a different team, but for some reason caught attention early and that you disproportionately hope does well, and one you end up privately sharing their triumphs and disappointments from afar. Today's guest is a man who's played international cricket for 5 years, who starred in the IPL, CPL, Big Bash, and the Blast T20 tournaments, but who still sees himself as almost starting out in the game. A man who was soon to be employed as a spin coach in India in the most competitive T20 league in the world at the age of 27. I'm pleased to say this week's lockdown cricket interview is with Black Caps leg spinner Ish Sodhi.
TP and a mask on here. Coronavirus. Please don't get me today, coronavirus. I still got cricket to play, coronavirus. And no, it's COVID-19. I'm sick of hearing your name on my TV screen. Isolate with me, it's not what it may seem. Avoid the 6 symptoms of COVID-19. Day 1 and day 2 was like kind of a dream. But now day 3 is upon us and this boredom's obscene. Supermarket's empty, now dinner's breadsticks. Praise the Lord for internet, we watching Netflix.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Following On podcast. You know, there's so much to talk about. Career going back a few years now, taking in New Zealand, taking in the IPL, taking in a whole host of things. First off, you know, what is it about that rap song?
Yeah, well, mate, you know, obviously, like a lot of people around the world at the moment, obviously in New Zealand, we're in a bit of a lockdown. So, yeah, just trying to reconnect with things that I enjoy doing outside of the game, and rap music's been one of them. It's helped keep me reasonably busy in this pretty uncertain time. So, yeah, I thought I'd put together a little rap song about coronavirus and put it out to the world on social media. And yeah, it's just a little bit of fun that I've always kind of tinkered with growing up, and no, it's good to be able to reconnect with it now.
We did a show a couple of weeks ago with Jason Holder, actually. And we asked him at the end of it to tell us his favourite tracks, and we played them out throughout the show. So what track should we introduce you to? I mean, we'll play out the rap song that you recorded, but if there was to be one song that you're listening to at the moment or your favourite song growing up, you know, how should this show start?
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt, I've got the song in my mind. It's Juicy by Biggie Smalls.
It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and pepper and Heavy D up in the limousine. Hanging pictures on my wall. Every Saturday, rap attack.
You might have to do the non-explicit version, which, you know, just for the viewers back home. But yeah, that's definitely the song that I'd like to walk out to on a cricket field. So it can be the podcast walkout song as well.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, music's always been your thing. I mean, did you grow up in a cricket family, in a music family?
Sport isn't really that big in my family. I'm probably the first person to take sport reasonably seriously. Although my mum had a couple of cousins that were wrestlers. I'm not too sure to what standard they got to in India. It was a long time ago. But yeah, my dad's a doctor and my mum's a teacher, so I grew up around people that were, you know, always had their head in paperwork and things like that. So yeah, it's a little bit of an outlier, but yeah, I found cricket at the age of 12. But yeah, I've always loved music. I grew up in a small town called Papatoetoe in South Auckland, and rap music was generally the preferred music of most of my peers. So I started growing up around that and started really enjoying it. Had a few freestyle battles in garages, on Saturday nights and things like that. So it's always been something I've enjoyed.
Did you just say that your mum's uncles or your mum's cousins were wrestlers back in India?
Yeah, well, they were wrestlers. So like back in, I'd say, the 70s and 80s, they used to be competitive wrestlers. And it's funny though, because like I look at myself and I stand about 6'2", 6'3", and both my parents are like 5'7" and under. So I've always wondered where I got my height from. And that's when I asked my mum the question. I was like, you know, why are you guys so tight? Am I adopted? You know? and so that conversation led to a little bit of a history lesson about my family. And a few of them were in the army at that stage, and a couple of them were wrestlers, and some of them stood, 6'6", 6'7". So it's a good indication of where my height came from.
Did you have the stereotypical battle with your dad wanting you to study and become a doctor, and you wanted to play cricket, or were they completely behind whatever you decided to do?
Yeah, that's a pretty big stereotype, eh? Might not be surprising, but I've been asked that question before. I think there is a bit of a stereotype, especially probably being of Indian origin, that there is a certain pressure for especially the men in families, I think, to be educated, well educated, maybe become a doctor or an engineer or things like that. But I was really lucky that we moved to New Zealand when I was 4 years old, and tried to immerse ourselves into the culture as best as we possibly could. And where my dad is a doctor, I think he found that kind of stereotypical pressure a lot when he was younger, and was probably forced into medicine as opposed to really, really wanting to do it. So I guess moving to New Zealand was a good start for him, because, he could start fresh, ended up working in mental health, which he really enjoyed, because it was more about people than about, he reckons dissecting organs is almost objective as opposed to talking to people about their, I guess, mental well-being. So he really enjoyed that. And that was something that I started to learn as well, that from a young age, it's really important to do what you love doing. And mum and dad supported that throughout. And thankfully I found cricket, because that's the thing that I love doing the most.
Back home in the UK, a lot's made of the fact that British Asian kids, that they make up a huge percentage of people participating in the sport, but there's a real drop off as it comes to late teenage years, and the UK Asian players aren't represented in the professional game in the UK as much as the statistics suggest that they should be. Is that a similar situation here?
I wouldn't know the numbers as such, and I couldn't really comment on it in that regard. But I can confirm that, especially my cricket club growing up, was, I'd say, 95% what you would call Asian. We would just say Indian, and there were a lot of Indians, a lot of Pakistanis that were playing cricket through the age groups and stuff. But you're right, there does seem to be a little bit of a drop off. And whether that does come down to maybe that stereotypical pressure of, going to university, or whether it's a cultural thing. I know for me, growing up, for example, something really small was that we'd eat dinner at 9:30 or 10 p.m. And I don't think that, helped my athleticism much at all, growing up during that period. So thankfully, when I finished school, having the support from mum and dad, and also being put into age group academies, I was able to learn those things, around athleticism and nutrition and all those kind of things that maybe we don't really get exposed to if we aren't in those, I guess, out of that culture a little bit. So, I'm not too sure why that's the case, but definitely does seem to be a little bit of a drop off, I think, now that you talk about it.
2015 World Cup, I was out here for that, and I found that the World Cup really captured the imagination in a way that, even in England, 2019, I don't think it came close. Of course, the final and all that. But what really impressed upon me when I went to Eden Park to watch the game against Australia, what a game that was, by the way, was the fact that it seemed to me that New Zealand were being supported by all the ethnicities that make up this country. And in a way that I don't see so much in England. I wouldn't see England play India in July in the semi-final, and I was stood at the train station in London going up to Birmingham. It would have been 95% UK Indian supporters wearing India tops. And I don't see that here so much. It does seem that whether you are European of ancestry, whether you're Pacific Island of ancestry, whether you're from India ancestry, it does seem like everyone supports New Zealand and everyone wants to wear the New Zealand kit. And I found that very different from the UK, but it's probably not even something you've even thought about, because why would you?
Oh, no. Well, to be fair, I have thought about that a little bit, and I'm a little surprised that you haven't seen that more in our country. I think especially if we're playing against nations other than India, then all of those Indian supporters in our country and all the other ethnicities definitely do get behind New Zealand. You know, we're such a small country and we all, you know, love sport and we love our nation, so we support it accordingly. But definitely when we play against India and we play at Eden Park, for example, where, because in Auckland the Indian population is so vast, you get a lot of Indian supporters. And I remember speaking to a couple of the Indian guys, you know, Kohli Rahane and things like that, and they said, yeah, it does feel like a bit of a home game when you come to Eden Park. But I've always thought, you know, how from a, you know, marketing commercial point of view, we can get those same Indian fans that come out in their droves and they're, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people there that come and support them. How can we get them supporting New Zealand when, say, Bangladesh is here, or you know, Sri Lanka's here, or something like that? Mm-hmm. So it's always going to be a challenge, but it just shows how much Indian cricket is loved, and you know, wherever they go in the world, it's a home game for them. But yeah, you constantly want to improve and make sure that your fan base is, you know, obviously supporting you, and you want to make it feel like somewhat of a home game in your own country. But yeah, you almost gotta be submissive to the fact that the Indians are going to have that kind of support wherever they go in the world.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You made your debut in the Plunkett Shield for Northern Districts. How did you find the transition to professional cricket?
2012 was the first time I played for Northern Districts in a first-class game. I would have been probably 19 when I signed with them, and maybe 20 when I played my first game. So, yeah, very young. Looking back now, you know, it was only 7 years ago, and I still feel like a young cricketer now. I mean, so in terms of being 20 years old and paving the way to play professional cricket, I felt, you know, looking back, it was a really speedy transition. Even though it felt for a long time, it was taking so long because, you know, all my career I'd played A-troop cricket for Auckland. And I had probably about a 2-year period outside of school where I was trying to get into the Auckland side, and it just felt so far away. And so those 2 years probably felt like they were, you know, 5 years. And when I finally got the chance to play domestic cricket professionally, it had felt like a long time coming. But now, obviously, being, you know, having had the experiences that I've had as a professional cricketer, and sitting here at 27 years old and thinking, you know, 7 years ago feels like a really long time. And, you know, most cricketers tend to, you know, probably come to their prime years, 30 plus. It does feel like a really long time ago, and I can't really comprehend, one, how I did it, and two, how long I've been actually playing for. So, yeah, it was a really, really quick transition, but the one that just feels like yesterday as well.
One of the things I noticed was that you made your test debut within, what, 12 months, 18 months of making your first class debut. I mean, you talk about things happening quickly. Do you think that happened a bit too soon for you, or were you ready at the time? And what was the mental process? How confident were you as a cricketer then?
I think in hindsight, I would have definitely have thought about that a fair bit, and I would have probably liked to debut a little bit later. But obviously, when you're 19, 20, 21 years old, and you have the prospect of playing international cricket, you're not going to turn away from it or anything like that. Definitely wasn't ready in terms of the, international cricketer that I probably wanted to be at that stage, but it was an opportunity that was amazing. And if you kind of look at it from the perspective of having only played 1 year of professional cricket and then going straight to playing test cricket, well, I'll put it to you and say in 2012, mid-2012, the only job I'd ever done was push trolleys at a grocery store and play club cricket and under-19 cricket. And the following year at the same time, within a year after playing the under-19 World Cup, I was playing test cricket. So, yeah, it was a really, really quick transition. And I'm not saying that, it's a bad thing or anything like that, because, guys like Daniel Vittori and Kane Williamson and things like that have become very, very successful international cricketers, and they started at the same age. But I suppose when you're growing up and you see guys doing that, you think that it's not easy at all, but it's achievable. But then you realise as well that everyone's journey is quite different. And if I had it, my way, I would have probably debuted a little bit later. But in saying that, it's given me some great experiences and great opportunities that have probably helped me become the person and cricketer that I am today.
I noticed in your first innings you top scored with 48, and you were a thorn in England's side. A couple of years ago, the test over here, has it always been leg spin your primary skill? And why did you choose leg spin as well? At 6'2", were there other options? Did you start out as a batsman? Where did the decisions lie? When did you realise that you had such a skill?
Yeah, look, I was always probably a batsman that used to dabble in a little bit of pace bowling, because I was obviously a lot taller and bigger than the other kids, so I could get the ball down at a decent clip. But to be fair, I started playing cricket quite late. I probably had my first game of cricket at 9 years old. I know a lot of people probably start at 5 or 6 or something like that. And it wasn't until probably 12 years old that I actually started enjoying the game. It was probably 3 years of bowling pace and batting, but it wasn't until I had the chance to be involved in an academy where Deepak Patel was the head coach. And, at that stage, he was a well-respected member of New Zealand cricket, and the fact that he had bowled spin as well was really cool. And once he just sat us down and asked if anyone in the group bowled spin, and no one put their hand up. So, I put my hand up. I wanted to impress this guy that played cricket for New Zealand, and obviously being a spin bowler, I just, decided to put my hand up for God knows what reason. And he put me in a net by myself, and, the only way that I could comprehend bowling spin was bowling a leggy. And, I just walked in, ambled in and bowled this leggy that, went down and it drifted, and then it hit the deck and then it spun. And from then, I became addicted. I thought it was just such an amazing art, and wanted to progress further. I went home and went onto YouTube, which was going, mad in those days, and googling leg spin. And then I found out who Shane Warne was, and I found out who Anil Kumble was, and Stuart McGill, and all these phenomenal leg spin bowlers. And, mate, I watched it for hours and hours and hours. And then I'd go to the nets and try to replicate it for hours again. And I just love it. I genuinely love leg spin bowling.
That's amazing. You say that age 27, you still feel like a new bowler, or a new cricketer rather. You're almost like you're still starting out. You've played a lot of 2020 cricket for New Zealand and in the IPL and around the world. You've played a lot of 50 over cricket and test cricket. Is there one that you don't feel quite the same way? Do you feel slightly slightly down the road further in 2020 cricket when you're playing for the Black Caps than you do maybe in the Test arena because you played more times? I mean, where's the mindset set in terms of your confidence as a cricketer across all three formats?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, if you have a fair bit more success in one format, you're probably going to tend to have more confidence in that. And I suppose from an international perspective, I've probably had my most success in 2020 cricket and then probably followed by one day cricket and then Test cricket after that. You know, being a huge purist of the game, you know, I think Test cricket is still the absolute ultimate. And, you know, obviously being 20 years old and being thrust into Test cricket, again, like we spoke about earlier, I don't think I was quite ready at that stage to play Test cricket. I'd only played 10 first-class games, where now I've got about, you know, 70, 75 first-class games under my belt. So I understand, one, what it's like to play for, you know, that long. And two, I probably understand myself as a person a lot better. And I understand what's required to be a really good Test bowler a lot more now than what I perhaps did back then. So I'd like to think that taking those learnings into play over the past 7 years of playing professional cricket, you know, a lot of spinners these days are playing, you know, well late into their late 30s and some of them even touching 40, you know, the likes of Rangana Herath, you know, comes to mind, Brad Hogg, you know, Warney was still playing, Anil Kumble was still playing. So it's still achievable. And, you know, while I still have the motivation to play Test cricket, I see why not, you know, take the learnings from the past 7 years and then let's say for, you know, 30 onwards, whether I can forge a successful Test career, I think is definitely a big goal of mine, where I don't want to put too much pressure on it as well. It's definitely something I want to achieve, but also continue with the success I've had in the white ball formats because it's been such an enjoyable run and one that I hope can continue for a little bit longer.
Mitchell Santner against England, I think he took the first wicket taken by a spinner in about 2 years or something in New Zealand. You know, I was chatting to Will Somerville last week actually, and is there a sense of frustration that actually Test cricket in this part of the world is being restricted? They don't play as much financially. It doesn't make as much sense. There's a lot more focus in ODI and T20 stuff, but also the pitches, they're green tops after nearly every game you see. So do you feel like you're kind of battling the conditions and just the fact that you're having to play Test cricket primarily in New Zealand?
Well, I think that, you know, they're very right. Bowling spin in New Zealand, especially at Test cricket level, is really tough because the wickets just don't allow for it that much. And I think you can probably have that same conversation with a lot of English spinners. You know, county cricket and, you know, unless the counties are producing absolute dust bowls, then playing a part as a spinner is quite difficult and you have to be really on the top of your game to be able to get wickets in our conditions. But in saying that, in the past, let's say, you know, 4 or 5 years that I've been involved, spinners are right at the top of our Plunkett Shield wicket takers. So for some reason, I find that the first-class wickets in New Zealand are starting to turn a lot more than what they do in Test cricket. And also, if you spin it around, I generally find bowling on day one in New Zealand a lot better as a spin bowler because there might be a little bit more moisture in the wicket, so it's a little bit tacky. And as the game progresses, they generally tend to die down. So the bounce becomes lower. The spin, if there is any, is really, really slow. And being a spinner, we'd rather the ball go straight and go quickly than it spin really, really slowly. And so I guess with taking all that into account, you have to have a huge amount of understanding from your captain and your teammates of how they use you as a spin bowler. And if it's going to be as an attacking weapon, then it has to be on day one and day two, which is so hard to comprehend because that's generally the best time for seam bowlers to bowl. And that's when I've had, you know, personally, my most success is like having Daniel Flynn as my captain, understanding that I'm the aggressive weapon. And there'd be times on day one and sometimes day two that I'd have the ball in my hand with 8 or 9 overs gone in the innings. And that generally made me a lot more of a threat to the opposition. But you know, I'm not sure whether that's a ploy to use in Test cricket because we obviously have one of the best seam bowling attacks, you know, in recent times in Bolt, Southey and Wagner. But it's definitely something to consider if we want spin bowlers to play maybe more of a part in Test cricket and over in our shores.
Have you always felt the backing of the captain over the last 7 years as an international cricketer. It seems at times the leg spin is always the one to to cop it, isn't he? I mean, partly because of the, yeah, well, as we all know, leg spinners can be expensive on occasion. The margins of error are much, much finer. And of course, the pitches aren't always suitable. It, you know, watching from afar, you've always been to me a player that I've enjoyed watching. I hope to do well. And I think that you've been more deserving of more opportunities than maybe you've had. Do you feel that pressure? Does it ever feel sometimes that, you know, the leg spinner is more often than not the full guy when the team as a whole doesn't produce the goods?
I suppose, you know, not just the leg spinner, but maybe the guy that's, you know, what I've been for a long time, you know, outside of T20 cricket, you know, is almost dubbed as the second spinner type of bowler. I guess, you know, you generally play your second spinner if you feel the conditions are going to be suitable. Are we ever going to play two spinners in New Zealand? Probably not. So you look at overseas tours and things like that, but generally those overseas tours, you know, include very, very good players of spin and that slow turn, what I speak about, as opposed to that quick turn, which makes you, you know, a really, really venomous attacking option, which sometimes you get in white ball cricket in those Asian conditions. But sometimes those grounds are, you know, are tough, and especially being a leg spin bowler, I think if you're not hitting the lengths as well as what a left arm spinner or you know, a Nathan Lyon or something will be hitting, then it's, you know, you stand out a lot more than those guys, and you can, you know, often go at, you know, 4 or 5 runs and over in those conditions, as opposed to going at that 2.5, like what those very, very accurate finger spinners do. So there's a challenge in itself, you know. Consistency and length is really important in those conditions. But in white ball cricket, I've always felt, you know, very, very backed, especially because I'm probably playing in this new age where, you know, most teams are looking to take wickets through the middle periods of T20 cricket and in one day cricket as well. And obviously having the protection helps for you to be really, really confident as a leg spin bowler, having fielders on the boundary that you can always come in and try to rip the ball as hard as you can. And naturally, you're probably more accurate doing that anyway. So, yeah, that backing in white ball cricket's been something that I've taken really well and really, really enjoyed from the captains that I've played under. And it probably allows me to play the role that I really enjoy playing. But I would love to transfer that same skill into red ball cricket, managing what that looks like from my perspective, from my bowling and from my probably tactical side of the game as well. And that's something that is a challenge for me to move forward with.
If you could pick one country to operate your art in that you've experienced so far, which one do you think lends itself to leg spin more than any other?
By far and away, I'd have to... Oh, not far and away. I'd say there's two places in the world that I think you get quick turn. One of them is Sri Lanka, and the other one I think is the Caribbean at times. You know, the Caribbean, you know, they're known for, obviously back in the day, about their really fast bowlers and their ability to bounce and you know, scare teams with their pace and stuff, where I think the wickets are probably a lot slower than perhaps what they used to be back then. And, you know, I remember playing in Kingston and Mark Craig was on debut and got 8 wickets, and man, these balls were hitting the length and spitting up to people's shoulders and things like that. And that was such an enjoyable place to bowl. The same in Trinidad, it turned a fair bit in a test match there. Obviously Guyana and the CPL is a big turning ground as well. But then Sri Lanka as well, I find that the pitches in Sri Lanka, they offer turn, but they offer it quickly. You know, guys like Runga Neherath have made it such a successful place. Definitely in my generation, obviously before that, it was Murali who, you know, could probably spin it on glass. So it doesn't really matter. But yeah, those are the two places I think if I could play day in, day out, take some rolled up pitches and have them back here, then those are the places I'd go to.
In terms of playing a game, because there's a lot of conjecture back in the UK about getting Test cricket back on the road, because the broadcast deals are so massive, and the same with Premier League football, Champions League football. The whole world is trying to work out how to get sport back. And one of the ideas is that it could be played in front of empty stadiums like you guys did against Australia in that one-off, in that ODI. In terms of playing professional sport without a crowd, you know, I've heard many sports people say when asked a question, how do you operate in front of 100,000 people or 50,000 people? And they say, well, you just kind of block it out after a while, and you're just so focused on, you know, what you're trying to do. Is the reverse true when there's nobody there, or was it just such a surreal and overwhelmingly obvious fact that there was nobody in the stadium that actually detracted from the performance and detracted from the heights that sports stars can actually reach?
Well, I think it was incredibly obvious that, you know, it was very different to anything we had experienced before. And I suppose because it was new, it was always going to be something to get used to in time. But I think if that's going to be the, you know, savior of sports, at least in the next wee period, and it's a chance to, you know, get sport back live on TV, because, you know, I'm just like everyone else sitting at home watching sport and watching all these reruns that, you know, Sky Sport back home in New Zealand is showing. Yeah, it's fantastic. But, man, it'd be great to watch some live sport again. But we went out in the middle. It was really empty. I remember, you know, obviously being on the boundary, trying to support the bowler, you know, saying, come on, mate, you know, keep going for us, Lockie, or something like that. I remember saying that into the stands, and it echoed all around the ground because it was obviously no one in the stands. So there's nowhere to hide in that regard. But generally, when you're performing a skill, you know, I think when you're batting or when you're bowling, apart from there being no noise, I think it's business as usual. And I think if that's going to be the normality for the next wee period, I think people are going to start getting used to it, and it's going to become easier and easier as we progress. But, I hope it doesn't last for too long if that's the case. Obviously, health and safety come first, but it's awesome being able to go out and playing in front of a crowd and everyone supporting the great game that we play in terms of cricket, and obviously other sporting codes as well. But yeah, I really look forward to one when sport starts again. And then obviously if we can manage to play in front of a crowd full of support, I think it'll be awesome. But health and safety obviously come first. You know, it's such a unique circumstance that we're in at the moment. So that's obviously the priority. And once that's over, I think the great thing is going to be that we're going to appreciate sport a lot more than probably what we did in the past. And so that can only be a good thing. But for now, I think the best thing to do is to try to obviously beat this virus the best way that we can. For us average shows, I think that's pretty much staying at home and isolating.
A huge thanks to Ish for taking the time out to talk to me. And you can hear more of his thoughts on what it's like to play in the Indian Premier League by listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 between 6 and 7 p.m. on Tuesday night. If you miss that, a podcast of the show will be made available in the next couple of days. Enjoy, and thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.